Ladies and gentlemen, it is election day in America.
Go vote!
And here at The Indicator, Cardiff and I believe in democracy. We believe that the powerful should answer to the people, and we believe in confronting questions head-on and not ducking and running like cowards.
In other words, folks, it is time for a listener feedback episode.
Yes, it is.
You, the listeners, have questions and comments that you've sent us, and even a couple of biting or stinging criticisms.
Which we also value.
We do. So today on the show, we respond. That's coming right up.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Peter Manning NYC, offering a line of apparel designed for the not-so-tall guy, including jackets that don't fit like a tent. Visit PeterManningNYC.com and use code NPR for 20% off your order. Support also comes from Capital One. Capital One's indicator is zero, because they offer accounts with zero fees or minimums, and they offer accounts that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One N.A.
Okay, folks. First things first, owning up to our mistakes.
Yeah.
On an episode about the history of GE, at one point I said that GE invented the jet engine. Nope, that honor actually belongs to Sir Frank Whittle. And oh, baby, did the engineers let me hear about that one. We love it, by the way, that so many engineers do listen to the show. But GE did, however, build the first American jet engine, the appropriately named GE-1A. And just earlier this year, fun fact, GE also test flew the biggest ever jet engine.
And second, on our episode about paydays, we talked about how people are getting paid every 2 weeks. And we refer to this as a bi-monthly pay schedule. And a lot of people pointed out that these two things are actually not the same. Getting paid every other week is not the same thing as getting paid twice a month. Because there are 2 months a year when you end up getting three paychecks. Those are good months.
Yeah. And by the way, like, I think this actually broke a record for how many emails we got. I never would have guessed.
Well, you know why?
So many.
Because
yeah.
People care deeply about paychecks.
I think they
this
also care deeply about those 2 months a year when they get that third paycheck.
I care deeply about those months.
Yeah, because they've learned to live on two paychecks a month. So those 2 months, for some people, like, it feels like finding, you know, $100 in the couch cushion or something.
Or in your coat pocket.
Yeah, we regret the wording on that one. Won't happen again. Thank you. And now let's do some questions. So here is a question from George Carnesis of St. Louis.
I've seen a lot of apartments going up in my area marked as luxury. And I was wondering, will the luxury apartments in my area affect my non-luxury apartment rent?
This is a great question. Of course, we're not experts on the specifics of the St. Louis housing market or how prices could be affected. But the answer is that this really depends on who moves into those luxury apartments or who buys them.
Yeah, for example, let's say the people who move into those luxury apartments were already living in St. Louis and they were upgrading from their upper middle class apartments. Well, then somebody has to move into the upper middle class apartments that they left behind. And the people who move into those apartments also leave behind apartments for people to move into, and so on. And if that happens, then the rent for all apartments in St. Louis would be lower than they otherwise would be, because it means there's more apartments, more supply, for the same number of people, and so prices have to stay low enough to attract new renters.
But if the people moving into these new luxury apartments are mostly rich people from outside of St. Louis, then the rents for everyone else might not change as much. So in fact, the luxury apartment building might mean your rent goes down. And maybe you can sneak into the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And by the way, that does not necessarily mean that it's a bad thing for more wealthy people to move into a city. That could have benefits, too. Like more local businesses open that cater to all these new people, like restaurants and movie theaters. Just a growing and a booming local economy and more jobs. So this is a complicated question. It just means that the rent on St. Louis apartments overall wouldn't be affected as much.
Yeah, and finally, the luxury real estate market is also controversial in some cities for another reason, which is that sometimes these luxury apartments are bought anonymously by rich foreign buyers. And sometimes what they're doing is trying to launder their dirty money by purchasing American real estate without even living in the apartment or renting it out. And so this would keep rents high, but without someone even living in those apartments. Miami is a good example of a city where this has happened, and regulators in recent years have been working on ways to stop this behavior. We really have no idea if this has happened in St. Louis, but we thought it worth mentioning precisely because of the controversy surrounding luxury apartment building in so many places.
Okay, our next question comes from listener Hugh Lee, who writes, quote, "How much money circulates around the world?" And we loved this question.
Yep.
It's so smart and interesting, and we actually might do a whole episode on it, if you don't mind. The short answer is that, once again, this depends. It depends on how you define money. So if you measure money by just physical bills and coins, the money that you can hold in your hands, you'll get an answer of roughly $8 trillion worth of money in the world, minus all the change that is in little bowls around my apartment.
So like $7 trillion?
Yeah. But you can also define money more broadly. So not just paper bills and coins, but also money in checking and savings accounts, money market accounts, time deposits. And that number is way bigger. That gives you an answer of $90 trillion. These numbers, by the way, come from a really useful website called Visual Capitalist, and its estimates are consistent with others that we checked out.
Yeah, but we also kind of want to take this opportunity to answer another question. Not just how much money there is in the world, but how much wealth is there in the world? In other words, what is the total value of everything that people own on the earth? All the cash and stocks and bonds and houses and everything that people own, minus the amount of money that people are in debt, the money that people owe.
Well, as luck would have it, once a year, researchers at Credit Suisse put out a huge report on this. And the answer is that there is $317 trillion in global wealth. About 31% of that wealth belongs to people in the United States. By this measure, the United States is the richest country on earth. There is almost twice as much total wealth in the U.S. as there is in China, even though China has four times as many people.
But of course, not all that wealth in the U.S. is shared equally. The richest 1% of American adults hold 35% of the wealth. And just, again, going by that measure, the United States is more unequal than other advanced economies like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. Their top 1% holds less of their country's total wealth. But the U.S. is more equal than Russia, India, and Brazil.
And finally, here's a question from Dan Urich.
In addition to the books you talked about in your mini-series, Economics Beach Reads, what are some other resources, websites, blogs, that you recommend to a young professional to learn more about investing or really just our economy as a whole? Thanks so much for taking my question. You guys rock.
Thanks, Dan.
Oh, I like Dan. Hey, Dan.
Yeah. In terms of economics, there are some like classics of the genre that a lot of people love, like Robert Heilbronner's The Worldly Philosophers, John Macmillan's Reinventing the Bazaar. But the single book that I actually have been going to in recent years when people ask me this question is actually Tim Harford's The Undercover Economist Strikes Back. We've had Tim on the show a couple of times, and you'll notice that Tim has a really exceptional talent for telling a simple and a very easily understood and yet still incredibly interesting story about economics. And The Undercover Economist Strikes Back is his book on macroeconomics, so on the really big themes that are happening in the economy. And it's just a lovely way to get into economics. And that is my recommendation.
So my recommendations are a little bit more like day-to-day practical.
Okay.
There is an app that I really like from The Economist called the Espresso app. It's just a little summary of the day's news. And The Economist just does a really nice job of looking at stories all over the world and summing them up in these really sharp ways. So I really like that app. And then also the blog Marginal Revolution is really good. They take news stories every day. They take really unexpected approaches. Sometimes the economics gets a little complicated, but the writing is really good. And they link to stories all over the place about like different sort of economic moments and things you wouldn't think about. So I really also love that blog.
Okay, we hope you've enjoyed this We Respond to You episode. And finally, over at our website, we'll have links to the Credit Suisse report on wealth, the visual capitalist numbers on money, and a really interesting piece on luxury real estate in Miami. So for those links, go to npr.org/money and also follow us on Twitter. We are at The Indicator. Also,
if you want to go vote, you should go vote.
Yes, I encourage you to go vote. I think you should
Me
vote.
Too. Me
I think
too.
People should vote.